This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy. I have a Nat Geo book, and I'm always happy when I have a Nat Geo book. So I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Christina Sauer. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. I don't know. She will tell me. Hi, Christina.
Hello. And yes, you do have my name right. Thanks so much for having me here.
Oh, it's always so exciting for me to have someone from Nat Geo. I love you all. You know, I was thinking, I was pretty sure it was pronounced Sauer, although I knew you would be so sweet.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah, it's one of those weird ones with a bunch of vowels in it. So it's the only spelling you'll find the sour is in sauerkraut. So
that's
people are like, oh, you don't spell that. That's as close as you get.
Yeah. Well, again, it's just wonderful to have you. And today we're talking about, you know, this is one of my favorite times of the year because you guys come out with the almanac for the year 2024. My goodness, can you believe that's already... it seems like, you know, 1999 wasn't so long ago.
Oh my gosh, every time we come out with these books, I'm like, wait, when did we get to the 2020s? It just feels like a blur.
It does. Well, of course, you know, for me... I've spoken to so many Nat Geo authors, photographers, editors, and it is always a thrill. And where do you fall? Are you the editor?
I am an editor. I have a wonderful team surrounding me of authors and photo editors and designers, but I get the pure joy of seeing the book come to life from early outline all the way to when it's released into the world. So it's quite a fun job.
Oh, I know. And I love that you did use the term pure joy because that's what I'm all about here. And you're right. This book is pure joy. And, well, I always say nowadays that people always tell their kids, grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer. But boy, oh boy, if I was going to have more kids, I'd say, grow up to work for Nat Geo, because not only will you have fun, you're working, but you're having fun.
Oh, it's so true, and you feel like you have a mission behind everything you do, and I swear, every day I learn something new here. We have so many different sciences informing us and explorers, research coming in, that I feel like, today I'm going to learn about dinosaurs. Tomorrow it might be the deep sea. It's a really great place. And, I mean, we love to share whatever we've gathered throughout the year and found out with kids and empower them so that maybe they're going to be the next explorer or the next editor. You never know.
Well, not just with kids, because everybody up to 120 will love this book. It is the... of course, 500 photographs from Nat Geo, and we're talking the best photographs in the world. And every time I find things that I didn't know, and I love it, like, what is a patamelon? I never heard of that one. I never even saw that word. A young red-legged patamelon stays in mom's pouch for its first 6 months of life. Woo! I thought that was so cool. I have to go to Australia.
I want to go to Australia too. And we love adding these animals in, or even dispelling some of the myths about common animals that you find, like the fact that our elephants afraid of mice, and we say no, actually they're not. They have their vision is so blurry that they wouldn't even be able to see a little mouse. But it's just a common myth that we have. We also include, if you like the patamelon, you have to check out the section on our quokkas, They are the happiest animal on the planet because they just have the cutest expression on their face, and we literally just do a whole spread filled with photos so kids feel like, oh my gosh, they're so cute, I want to learn more.
I know, and they are, well, they're adorable. There's so many things. This is, you know, I've told the other editors at Nat Geo that really your magazines changed my life because I grew up in northern Michigan where we had long winters with lots of snow. And when we got those magazines, it was like sunshine just pouring in. And we spent hours and hours reading those magazines, and that's why I became a world traveler. I owe so much to Nat Geo. And I can tell you, the other kids in my town, we did not share our Nat Geo books, by the way. I'm sorry, but but you couldn't, because you wouldn't get them back. I'm very grateful to you, and so that's why I love this. And this is really, I'm telling everybody, get this book for every kid in your life, because you don't really want to share it, but also for all the adults. If you have anybody, a senior in a senior's home, send this book, because it is hours of fun, just pure fun.
It's true, and your story is such an inspiration to me, because that's honestly what we try to do with this book. We broke it down into 12 chapters on everything from what do we think is coming up in 2024 that's really relevant. We call it Your World. And talk about everything from like the cool events, like the Summer Olympics that we'll see next year, to a Taco Tuesday up on the International Space Station. But we also break it down into subjects that every kid and adult, or any age, honestly, would be interested in. So from learning about the environment, and we have this kids versus plastic, breaking down what is this issue with plastic, and why is it such a problem? Because many kids don't realize that plastic can exist all the time. We only really saw its popularity and creation during World War II times. To space and Earth, and what's happening out in space, and what are these beautiful images that they're coming back from James Webb? We talk about exploration, and we feature explorers and talk about when they were children. What inspired them to become who they are today? Because they didn't think, just like you and I, when we're sitting there reading our magazines and our books, going, oh, I could never do that. And he said, yeah, you can. I just had a fascination with bugs, and that's where I got to be an entomologist in the rainforest. So we really just focus on every subject that, one, teachers and parents want their kids to get invested in, because it is part of the curriculum, too. But we do it in such a way that you never feel like you're really learning. You're just having fun and learning fun facts, or learning fun facts through jokes or tongue twisters.
Oh, I love the jokes. I love the jokes. I love all the little quizzes. It just makes it so much fun. And as a homeschool mom, I always use Nat Geo books, to get them enthusiastic. And it was funny. One of the things that I like to do is to teach them art. I said I would give them a photo from, the magazine. I'd say, here, now draw it, and or paint it. And they became little artists at a very young age, because they would copy, the beautiful photographs from Nat Geo books.
Oh, well, that opens up. If you're a homeschool mom, you're going to love our section on our Almanac Challenge. Every year, we love to do this challenge where we ask kids to do exactly what you're already doing with them. We ask them, we give them a prompt, and this year we talk about our elephant Instagram stories. So there's an amazing woman. She's out studying the behavior of elephants. She's from Mozambique, and basically her name is Dominique Gonçalves. And we ask, okay, so what if you were that researcher? What if an elephant had social media? What do you think the elephant would say? How would you raise awareness, and what would you want to share with friends and followers? And not only do we start their creative juices flowing, being like, okay, pretend you're an editor or a photographer or an illustrator, but also create this and then submit it. And we actually feature the winners every year in the almanac for the following year. So we'll have the winner of this elephant social media profile next year in the almanac. But we also will do it in our magazine. So you get to be a published illustrator, author, designer as a kid.
Oh, well, this is the spirit of Nat Geo, the spirit of really encouraging people to think, to wonder. You know that you have it both ways. You get a Nat Geo magazine, a book, and you're looking at the photographs, for example, of the animals, and just the one, I love the one of the camels laughing. I thought that was, that's so good. And you just sit there for a minute and you're thinking, do they laugh? I mean, what's so funny? You know, and so you're wondering, and then you decide, well, you know, maybe I should go somewhere and see some camels. So you start wandering. It's all there in a Nat Geo book. I love, you know, I've spoken to so many of the authors. Carlton Ward was on not too long ago because he did this wonderful book about the Florida panther, and you know, I'm here in Florida, so I was interested in that. But there's one explorer. I got such a kick out of this guy's story. And you have these explorer stories and also about their epic fails. So yeah. I got such a kick. I would love to meet Maurice Onyango. And he's got this photograph. And he starts off, it's a photograph of a snake, a deadly snake, one of those deadly snakes. And he starts off by saying, I'm terrified of snakes.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, Maurice, I want to hear your story.
Well, and we make it relatable, too. I think sometimes we tend to think of scientists or explorers or the people doing them, or even writers, as these individuals who are so far beyond ourselves, and they're always perfect. And we kind of admit science isn't perfect. It's always evolving and changing, and people make mistakes, but that's the beauty of it. Like, to quote Miss Frizzle, right? Like, make mistakes, get messy. Like, that's kind of what this is, and so kids get to see that. Nothing is ever perfect. You can laugh alongside and go on these journeys with them as they're doing their research in the field and meet a snake that they're deadly terrified of.
I thought that was so funny. Of all the things, you know, when you're afraid of snakes, to go out there, and he took 500 photos of them. But partly because his hands were shaking so much. It's a lovely story. Now, as the editor, I do feel that it's very important. An editor should actually know about what they're putting in a book. So did you actually eat some of the food that is mentioned in this book? Now, I wouldn't mind eating the marzipan pig that's traditional to Germany. But what about, did you get a sample of French fry flavored soda in Japan?
Okay, that's one that I actually really want to try. As soon as we start putting in these facts, I was like, ooh, what does that taste? Is it salty? Is it? So there's a part of me, like you said, now just wants to go visit Japan so I can try this French fry soda. Although I may not try the deep fried tarantulas in Cambodia. I think there are braver souls than I am, but I can barely look at a picture of a tarantula, let alone try to put it in my mouth.
Well, you're very much like my brother. I terrified him when he was a child. I took him to a movie called Tarantula, and and he had a bit of a breakdown. He started screaming. They kicked us out of the theater. He was screaming all the way out until we got near a bakery, and I bought him a donut and shoved it in his mouth. And he had been screaming for about 10 minutes. So, yeah, that one, I'm thinking of sending him this book just so he turns to that page. But the one that I would try and I would love, this they could have this vending machine right here in the studio. As a matter of fact, I'm going to suggest to the owner that she puts a vending machine here, because what they do in Singapore is, I mean, this is my dream vending machine, frozen Norwegian salmon.
Oh.
Now that.
Are you a big salmon?
I love salmon.
Lovely.
I love frozen Norwegian. So that's a good one. So all of these fun things that are in here, people will just get such a kick out of it. I'm glad that I don't think the royal family serves swan anymore.
No, definitely not, thankfully. But it is fun to learn about and see what was eaten in the past. What are we eating today? What do I want to try? Because sometimes, you know, you don't get as much exposure in the area you live in of these different foods, and it might inspire you. Who knows, maybe there's a budding chef out there who goes, ooh, I need to go travel that country and try this.
Yeah, exactly. So what are some of the things that you found the most surprising that you had no idea about until somebody brought it to you?
You know, honestly, in this whole book, my favorite section is always in the amazing animals, the dino section. I mean, who doesn't love a good dinosaur story? But I don't think I quite grasped how rapidly changing paleontology or the study of dinosaurs is. I always thought, oh, you know, they're really old. We'll discover new ones. But there can't be that much research and that much turnover every time. And I am always amazed. Every year, we have a section of newly discovered dinos. And this year, we have four. So we not only discovered four, but now we have new names for them. We talk about how big they were. And we have illustrations. And we think there are so many differences in what we thought. Some of them are now semi-aquatic or live sometimes on land, sometimes in the water that we thought were purely water animals, and we explain why. So for me, that's always the thing that surprises me the most, because I keep thinking there's no way we're going to discover a whole new species. And then we do.
And then you do, exactly. Well, this little golden snub-nosed monkey, I never saw that, and I thought, well, it looks like a toy. It doesn't look real.
Oh, yes, and did you read the Deadly Cuties section, too, on the lorries, who are the most venomous primate in the world, but they're so adorable, you just want to snuggle with them?
Oh, every page is just delightful, and the praying mantis, that photograph, how a photographer was so patient to get that exactly at the right time, that praying mantis looks exactly like a bishop. I mean, so
yes.
Dignified.
Well, we have some amazing photo editors who call through all of the photos that are in the world, and especially from our explorers. And we really try to get ones that are, exactly to your point, very engaging, and you feel like you're right there, or they look very regal. Even our cover of our wolf, I'm making eye contact with you, where you're like, I cannot help but pick up this book because I feel like it's drawing me in.
Oh, it is. It's a beautiful cover. It's always great covers, but I love this cover. Whoa. It just, what, and of course, for Florida, we are very happy with the pink power flamingos, because our airport now has this gigantic flamingo to welcome everybody to Tampa. Those are beautiful.
Oh, I had no idea. Aren't they great? And the fact that they get their pink coloring from the food that they eat, they're not just naturally pink.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I also love the one, again, because of Florida, the name of hurricanes that are coming up for 2024. And I noticed that they have, for P, they have Patty, P-A-T-T-Y. And,
oh, my goodness.
Yes, but really, somebody has to send in my name and say, well, Patsy would be a more, you know, that'd be a really outstanding name for a hurricane. So
I think you should.
Yeah.
I think in 6 years from now, that should be the one that fills the P slot.
Yeah, because I don't think, there's nobody else named Patsy, as far as I can discover. And I'm waiting. The first author who names their baby Patsy will get a prize. So,
I love that.
Yeah, well, you know, my name is Patsy with a Z. And so it's very unusual. And, of course, Jimmy Hoffa gave me that name. So not too many people actually ever sat on Jimmy Hoffa's knee. So, but I'm hoping, you know, maybe I will be a hurricane in 2030 or something. The years are going fast. Unbelievable. 2024, you're right, you know, when you think about it, we went through the pandemic-y years and we didn't know, we got all sort of confused.
Oh, I feel like my world's turned its head upside down. And it's funny because these books are quick in production because we want to make sure that we update everything so that it's really relevant for the year it comes out. So honestly, we're already working on 2025 now, and it it's kind of surreal thinking, wow, what's the world going to be like 2 years from now?
Exactly. Well, it is going to be filled with wonderful photographs because all of your people are out there constantly, you know, taking this. They have to be so patient sometimes. They have to wait so patiently to get just that right shot, but they do. And it's just always so exciting to be able to talk to both the explorers and the editors, because I know that you're having fun. There's of course the section about planets. I love that. I've always loved astronomy, so I went right to that section. And rocks, I just think that's such a great section.
Oh, and that's the beauty of this book for parents and kids and librarians, is that each chapter, the book doesn't need to be read cover to cover. A kid could choose what their favorite, or adult could choose their favorite subject and go right into it and learn some of the basics. Like you said, there are things in there that we don't update quite as often. We'll update the design, but, you know, rocks and minerals don't change that much from year to year. We still have igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary. We explain what those are. But then we throw in like our space and earth section, you know, questions that kids are asking parents or themselves, like, what would happen if the sun disappeared? And then we answer it. So it really touches on like child's curiosity, what they're thinking about day to day, and then also supplementing it with that foundational knowledge of a specific area of science.
And I love the one. Well, I love the fill in the blanks. I thought that was great. I love where the letters are mixed up and people have to, you know, get them in the right order. Just all these little things that make this book so much fun. And that's why I say that it's, of course, now summertime for children. It's so important that you get them to read during the summer. Because, first of all, they do lose a lot of learning if they're not constantly given books during the summer, so that they can read, see words, start thinking about things. And a Nat Geo book, there's a Nat Geo book, once you read the almanac and a kid finds a particular interest, if they're interested in whether they're interested in animals, then you can move on to the animal books that Nat Geo has, or if they're interested in science. There's so many scientific books. I love all the recent books that you've had about space travel and astronauts. But there's a book for every interest. And I think, you know, for me, as I said, it's really important. And one of the things that I do, I like to send books to children's hospitals. This book is a perfect book to send to a child in a hospital. If you don't, you don't have to know a kid in the hospital, just contact your local children's hospital, or you can do Shriners, or you can do St. Jude, and send them. Get their address, and you can just mail it directly to the hospital. And this will give hours of fun to a kid in a hospital.
Oh, it's so true. And this is the perfect book, like you said, for those road trips or sitting by the pool during the summer, because we not only have all these fun, engaging stories, each story is only 1 to 2 pages long. So as soon as you've read that, you have a new subject that you turn to. But we also have a really fun section that kids can engage with each other and their parents or their older siblings, called Laugh Out Loud, and you have games and tongue twisters and jokes that you're going to love and crack up and make that time pass by if you're in a car or sitting by a campfire. So I highly recommend sending this to anyone who just needs a good, like we said earlier, sense of joy in their lives.
Exactly. And for kids, this is a wonderful way for them to perhaps talk to their grandparents if they're not around, you know, if they're not readily available, you know, if they're not in the same town, you can still do Zoom calls, which are wonderful ways to get kids to explain what they're reading to their grandparents and have these jokes and have these fun things. So there's so many things that a Nat Geo book gives to you anyway, but the almanac is really special. So the Almanac 2024, wow, it's a fantastic book. And Christina, I think you're, you know, a very lucky person. And I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. I know you're going to have a fun day because you're at Nat Geo.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And yes, you can find this book wherever your favorite books are sold, whether it's online or in bookstores. And again, so excited to be on the show and to share. I love your enthusiasm for this book because that is the enthusiasm we put into this book.
And I want to remind everybody, go to Nat Geo Kids' website because they have more photographs, they have videos, they have all sorts of stuff. That is one of the best websites ever for children. Bye-bye now. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye. All right. Let's have a... Do we have anything? We're going to do commercials. Let's do commercials, and then my guest should be here.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. And this is a fascinating book. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Gary Simmons, I should say Dr. Gary Simmons, and the name of his book is Death's Pale Flag. Hello, Doctor.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. It's truly an honor.
Well, it's a thrill for me to have you here because it's a subject that I'm interested in, and I thought, wow, when I got this book, I didn't know what to expect, and I think you've done it so cleverly. You've made the whole subject of neuroscience and a neurosurgeon interesting. So tell us about how you came out with this idea. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the title. The title is, let's say, you like Shakespeare?
Yes, I'm a bit of a Shakespeare nut. I tend to always have several books on him or his plays at the bedside. And it's a line right out of Romeo and Juliet. It's where Romeo first discovers Juliet and believes her to be dead. And he's commenting that she hasn't lost the blush in the cheeks of life, hasn't gone pale with death. And so he's bemoaning that she's dead, but death's pale flag hasn't been hoisted yet.
And I thought that was a great title. Very for anybody who remembers Romeo and Juliet, they'll remember that. And then we go on to this subject. It's about a doctor. And when I was young, I worked in a hospital as a, in those days we could work as candy stripers, you know, and volunteer in hospitals. So I did that from the time I was 14. So I spent a lot of time in hospitals and getting to know doctors and seeing what life was like for them. So here you are writing a story about a surgeon. So tell us about your surgeon in your, because a lot of it is, I think, based on your life, and it's your doctor's name is Ryan Brennan. Tell us about Ryan.
Well, part of what I wanted to do with the book is really give people a great glimpse, at least behind the curtains, of what's going on in modern medicine, and particularly in my world of neurosurgery and brain surgery. And I thought I could write it as nonfiction. I've written other nonfiction books, but I thought fiction would really be much more immersive for the readers and be able to kind of be there in the operating room with the main protagonist, Ryan. And so Ryan is a neurosurgeon. Ryan Brennan's a neurosurgeon, and he's definitely deeply invested in his patients and the care of his patients and their families, and he's in the mix of it. I mean, he's at a busy trauma center where lots of terrible things are coming in all the time, and when you're in a trauma center, it's not just trauma, it pulls in all the emergencies, and so he's just seeing awful things happening all the time to people, but he's overcommitted. You might put him in the workaholic category, and so his exposure to this world is near constant, the wheels start to come off. He actually begins to see ghosts.
So you sort of when you think about it, you don't actually want your neurosurgeon to see ghosts, but it is such a difficult field. Well, being a doctor in general is very difficult, not from the academic or, it's just emotionally such a strain. And the kind of work that neurosurgeons do, it's the strain on their entire being is enormous.
It certainly can be, and, you know, everybody's going to respond to it differently. The protagonist, Ryan, in this case, is beginning to buckle under it. He's beginning to feel it too much, if you will. Now there are many who kind of go numb and don't feel it. And I may have been more in that category myself, where I was able to kind of wade through awful things many times a day, and just move from one thing to another. But an interesting phenomenon happened when I retired from clinical neurosurgery a couple of years ago, and pretty soon thereafter, I started experiencing things much more emotionally than I had been for the last 30 some years, where just, you know, things that are happy and things that are sad, they impacted me much, much more than they had been. And I think, you know, you throw up all these walls that may be protective, but they may not be all that good for you as well.
Well, it's true. For me, it's so funny. When I was young, when I worked in the hospital in those years, and then I went on and I did some work in laboratories, so as a, you know, in medical technology kind of stuff. And when I could take it. I could, you know, watch surgeries. I could, you know, be right there watching them cut people open, and it didn't bother me at all. I couldn't do that today if you paid me cash. I now if I cut my finger and I see blood, I can't take it. I can't take it.
Well, see, I bet you could, and I think a lot of it is, you know, what you get used to, what you're immersed in all the time. And there's a long process in developing physicians and surgeons, you know, and it I think everybody goes through adjustment periods.
But I did think this was a great way to sort of get into the entire subject of surgery in general that you are able to write about so well in the book. Take us really into the operating room.
Well, thank you. Part of what I wanted to accomplish was for people to kind of see that world, see what is happening, what kind of diseases are going on and what kind of injuries are occurring. But I also wanted, for the readers to also recognize in so seeing these things, just how fragile life is. We often take it for granted, and we live in a kind of sterile world anymore where we're very separated from death and dying and that sort of thing. And yet, if you're on those front lines in a modern American medical center, you're seeing it all the time. And you recognize that it is so fragile. It can all be turned upside down in a split second. You know, if you live near a hospital, every time you hear the helicopter pass over, that's somebody's life. That's a whole family's life and all their friends and connections being turned upside down. And so part of it was to also see and feel what the patients are experiencing and how they ended up there and how devastating it is, so that we all learn to kind of cherish what we have and really make the most of what we have and not take it for granted.
Well, you do that. And with Ryan, you know, as you say, he's taking it all so deeply into him, and you worry about him. You know that it's just overwhelming. And the whole seeing ghosts, there's right away this feeling that you want to protect him somehow. You wish he wouldn't have to, you know, go through anything.
Yeah, and with the ghost side of it all, and him encountering really an escalating slate of ghosts, I wanted the readers to be able to consider, well, could these be real? Are these real, or is he losing his mind? And play with that idea as well. But then I also wanted them to think about, well, what's actually more scary, the supernatural world or the natural world of what Ryan's experiencing? But he's flawed, and I don't want him to be a superhero. You know, he's flawed. He is deeply immersed in this. There's probably, you know, significant reasons for it, reasons to kind of need to be a heroic person. But he is not very good at his own emotional intelligence or what we call self-compassion and his own self-care. And he really doesn't listen to the people around him telling him he needs to take better care of himself, everywhere from his wife to his friends to professionals. And so it just gets deeper and deeper for him.
Well, you know, one of the things I was wondering, how now for you, and thinking about it, what do you feel about this robotic surgery?
I think medicine is probably going to go through some major, what they might call, disruptions. I heard you talking with one of your other guests in past interviews, some about AI, but AI, when you really think of it, I really wonder how long it's going to be before you're able to kind of wake up and say, hey, talk to your computer and say, hey, I don't feel so good today, and the computer starts asking you the symptoms, and you put your finger in some sort of sensor, and it can do all your blood chemistries and all, and then the computer says, oh, you know, you have COVID. Here, let's get you some Paxlovid or something like that, and actually treat you. So I have no doubt that there's going to be huge disruptions in the way we practice primary care, and I used to tease my residents about this. The residents are neurosurgical trainees. I would tell them, don't get all smug, because the world of robotics is getting more and more fine-tuned, and probably will be someday where a robotic system can do it better than a surgeon can. And we already use robotics in quite a few of our surgeries. It doesn't actually do the surgery. It just gets us to the places where we want to do it, where in the old days we would use dead reckoning, if you will. Those days are coming. And, you know, anything that makes the surgeries less traumatic for the patients and anything that makes the surgeries safer for the patients, I'm all for. But it's going to take a while.
Well, when you decided to write this book, did the idea of the ghost's involvement come immediately? I mean, or did you just want to write a novel about a doctor first?
Yeah, I've always wanted to write more about the actual life in neurosurgery. But since I was a kid, I was pretty immersed in the supernatural or paranormal world through my mother and grandmother, and read, you know, a billion books as kids, ghost stories and that sort of thing, and watched all the scary movies and all that. Probably since a child, I wanted to write ghost stories. So it actually, to me, ended up meshing well, because I said to myself, if the character is going insane, his interface with so much death and tragedy, it might be a natural psychotic, a natural break in reality to start thinking you're seeing people who have died. But I also thought, okay, what if we take the tack that the ghosts are real? Well, maybe somebody who spends so much time right on the edge of people's death, like a brain surgeon. And in the book, we talk about it being a bridge between life and death. Well, the surgeon is there, right there on the bridge, watching quite a few people go over, trying to snag a few and pull them back to the living. Well, if you were the ghost, maybe you would see him as somebody fairly familiar, and somebody easier to reach out to and touch or influence or communicate with, or something like that. So anyway, to me, it became relatively straightforward to blend the two worlds, and I think the crux of it was, there's just so much death and dying involved.
Well, you handle the sort of the difficult parts very well. I enjoyed particularly the operating room. You explain it in a very a way that everybody can understand, and I think it's, the writing is just excellent. So I don't know if we're born to write novels, but after now that you're retired, you certainly have another career for yourself if you want to continue writing.
Oh, well, you are too kind, but that warms my heart coming from you. So thank you so much. Yeah, I have two other novels kind of percolating right now. One I actually wrote before this, but this one just all of a sudden kind of came bursting out. I was like, I became kind of obsessed about getting this done, and it actually, in the beginning, came out, 260,000 words. So I did a lot of editing.
Well, I think this book is beautifully written, very readable, and a great read for people. It's called Death's Pale Flag, and it's by Gary Simmons. Do you have a website you want people
to? I do. It is my name, just Gary R. Simmons, but Simmons is spelled S-I-M-O-N-D, D as in dog, S. So Gary R. S-I-M-O-N-D-S .com.
Okay, and
so
people,
it's pretty easy.
And it's available online. It's a fine read. You'll enjoy it, and it opens up. I think you do start questioning: is he seeing ghosts, or perhaps, you know, so many people have these death experiences where they come back, and they're telling you there are really ghosts in the room. So you never know. People, you should read this book, Death's Pale Flag. And thank you again, Dr. Simmons, for being on Joy on Paper.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so very much for having me.
Well, I think, now you can throw in, for the next book, you might have a mystery. You can do all sorts of things. Doctors see so many things in hospitals that I'm sure you can have a lot of different books coming out, okay? And you'll be back here on Joy on Paper.
Sounds perfect.
Okay. Special thanks to Kim Dower for sending me this book and for sending you to Joy on Paper.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. A great book, really. I just really had fun reading this book. Okay, I am actually going to leave a little bit early today because I have a meeting. But I wanted to do two things. First, I want to play Jim Lamb, one of his wonderful literary gems, because he wants to help authors to think in terms of adding dimension to their writing. So we're going to play a Jim Lamb, very, very nice one, about onomatopoeia, when you'll discover what that is. And then I'm playing Haley Woolbright, has been a guest on the program, and I want to play her song, Boxcar, because she sent me a lovely note. And also, I want to thank a young woman I met today named Nisha, who helped me when I was in trouble in the parking lot. I just want to thank her, as she said she'd be listening. So we're going to go ahead with Jim Lamb and then with Boxcar.
Onomatopoeia. What's that? Pizza topping? A language spoken on a planet long ago and far, far away? Something the Three Stooges used as a punchline? Wrong, wrong, wrong. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. Buzzes. Hisses. Clang. Bang. Sizzle. Great words all, but less than they seem. Why? Because they're words that don't stand for what they are. They phonetically imitate what they describe. For example, when I said buzz, you probably thought of a bumblebee or a front door buzzer. When I said hiss, a snake may have come to mind, or maybe a leaky tire. Clang, a bell. Bang, a gun. And sizzle? A big juicy steak. But it's not just things that make sounds. How about animals? The cow goes moo, the pig goes oink, the duck goes quack. Guess what my favorite sound is? If you said you are right. Some of my favorite word imitations are in The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. Can you hear it? Tap, tap, tap. Rap, rap, rap. I did. So the next time you write about a clock, make it talk by saying tick-tock. That would be a great way to make your story more dynamic, dramatic, and engaging. Me, wow. I'm Jim Lamb, and that's a little something-something about onomatopoeia.
Back home, or I could choose to keep moving on. And I've been traveling along for the ride. Colored the Smokies, braved the Rockies, and rolled the hills of the countryside. But things change and people do too. This freight train is running its course. I'm still gonna make it out west, so I'll hop on a new line with no remorse. My time is come and gone. Maybe I'll stay my welcome, but I've outgrown this boxcar and I'm headed down the rails. I'm headed down the rails again. I've seen so much beauty from inside this boxcar. Bye.